Two rounds of chemotherapy, two autologous bone marrow transplants, which were done in tandem in 2006, and all of the related care. HMSA paid for the care he needed, including, after the insurance commissioner reversed his denial in this case, the allogeneic bone marrow transplant requested in February of 2007. With the court's permission, I'll refer to the autologous bone marrow transplant, which uses the patient's own stem cells as allogeneic bone marrow transplant, which uses the stem cells from a matched sibling donor or matched donor as an allotransplant.
Were these stem cells from the bone marrow or were they from other parts of the body?
There are a couple ways, as I understand it, Your Honor, in order to obtain the bone marrow. From the actual bone marrow, drawn marrow is one of the ways. I understand that the technology has advanced to the point where you can also draw the bone marrow, or the stem cells from circulating blood. And I think Dr. Humphrey addressed that in his testimony. In this case, I'm not entirely certain where the stem cells were drawn from Mr. Adams for the auto transplant or from the sister for the allo transplant. But there are a couple of different ways that the stem cells can be obtained. The request in this case in February 2007 for the allo transplant was made February 7th. HMSA issued a final determination February 23rd. A month later, the external review hearing was held, and that very same day, March 23rd, 2007, the commissioner informed HMSA that its decision had been reversed, and HMSA had provided coverage. This appeal followed. The issue before the external review panel under the external review statute, section 432B-6, is whether HMSA acted reasonably. If HMSA had a specific exclusion from coverage for allotransplant to treat multiple myeloma, then it was clearly reasonable to deny coverage on that basis, on the language of the contract.
Counsel, could you point to me, I have the plan before me that's attached to ASTRA degree stage. Could you point where specifically this procedure is excluded from the plan?
Yes, sir. The first place a member would turn in looking to determine whether a procedure was excluded would be in Chapter 6, the services not covered chapter, and that is, has the first page of that chapter has a Bates number on it as attached to the commissioner's answering brief with H000222. It's page 47 in the guide. If you turn two pages beyond that to the page Bates number 226, you find at the top of that page an exclusion for transplants. And in the left margin, you find the language transplant services or supplies, mm-hmm. which which states you are not covered for transplant services or supplies or related services or supplies other than those described in Chapter 4. And if you continue down, it says that this includes, and without limitation, all forms of bone marrow or peripheral stem cell transplants. So the member then sees the reference to Chapter 4 and would turn over to that chapter, which is at the beginning of the commissioner's appendix. And on the page, base number page 000212, which is page 36 of the plan, you find the section organ and tissue transplants, and in the left margin, you find bone marrow transplants, which says, benefits for bone marrow transplants are limited to autologous and allogeneic bone marrow transplants for those specific diseases or conditions described in this section. Benefits are not available for autologous and allogeneic bone marrow transplants for any other diseases or conditions. And then, when you turn the page, you find the lists. There's one list for allogeneic bone marrow transplants and a separate list for autologous bone marrow transplants. And you'll know multiple myeloma is listed for auto transplant, which is what HMSA did provide coverage for.
So you're saying this was a bone transplant?
It was a bone marrow transplant.
But didn't you agree to say it wasn't clear? Where the stem cell was coming from?
The terms bone marrow transplant and stem cell transplant are used interchangeably, and the source of the cell is used to replace the bone marrow, whether they come from the bone marrow or from the peripheral blood supply. The coverage is the same under the plan, and the technology is also very much the same. What differs is how you obtain the stem cells, but once you have the stem cells, the procedure continues, whether they're drawn from the bone marrow or from the peripheral blood supply. As I understand it, I'm not a doctor.
Now, one of the issues in terms of whether the panel erred, the commissioner erred in interpreting this plan is the standard of review. And basically, it's your position, it's for the court to decide whether or not this procedure was specifically excluded, not the panel.
That's correct, John.
Now, what do you make of the statute then? 432E, I think it's 6, subsection 7, when they direct the panel to review the terms of the agreement, the insurance policy, the evidence of coverage. Why are they having the panel do that if it's not for the panel to decide?
The panel certainly has to be familiar with the terms of coverage so that they can be considered. For example, in this case, the exclusionary language, the panel reviews the exclusionary language, and if the panel had accepted my argument at the hearing that that was a specific exclusion, then the panel would have concluded at that point that HMSA had acted reasonably. In this case, the commissioner applied an interpretation of the language specifically excluded in the statute, which results in an absurd result for this reason. The commissioner expressly found that a reasonable person reviewing the plan language would be able to readily determine that allogeneic bone marrow transplant for this condition was not a covered benefit. And yet, the commissioner proceeded to require coverage.
But so doesn't the statute do that? But the statute says, number one, is it covered? And two, is it specifically excluded? So if it's not covered and not specifically excluded, then you go to the issue of medical necessity. So couldn't the panel find it wasn't covered, find it wasn't specifically excluded, and go to medical necessity?
The panel did, in fact, make the finding that it was covered and not specifically excluded. But, Your Honor, they did so applying an interpretation of language specifically excluded, which we have asked this court to reject.
The case you cite on the standard of review that it's a question of law for the court, contract excludes or not, that was a case from this court, and the language in that case said, when the terms of the contract are unambiguous, well, would this be considered somewhat ambiguous if we have all these people coming up with different meanings of it?
Well, if we're focusing on the contract, the commissioner expressly found that there was no ambiguity in the contract, that a reasonable person reviewing the plan language could readily determine that this was not a covered benefit.
But we're talking about whether or not it's specifically excluded. I think everybody agrees it's not covered, but the question is whether it's specifically excluded.
commissioner's finding, I believe, leads to the conclusion that the contract is not ambiguous, making the interpretation of the contract a question of law. What that gets us into, Your Honor, is interpretation of the statute and the words specifically excluded. What meaning are we to import into what is a fairly straightforward term, specifically excluded? Courts are very, very capable of determining what is specificity. What is a specific exclusion? That's the crux of the question here. And the commissioner argued for, and the circuit court adopted, a palpably erroneous standard of review for the commissioner's interpretation of the medical necessity statute, which the Hawaii Supreme Court in Paul's Electrical says probably not appropriate given.
You would agree, though, if we get to the issue of medical necessity, if we agree with you that the statute and the plan are clear, that this procedure was specifically excluded, it ends there, right?
That's correct.
But assume we go beyond that and we get to medical necessity, isn't the standard of review there publicly erroneous?
Whether a condition is medical necessity would be a question, a mixed, or is medically necessary would be a mixed question of law and fact, and there I believe under Chapter 91, it would be a clearly erroneous standard of review.
And what's the difference between the two?
I don't believe there's a great deal of difference, Your Honor. In fact, in one of the cases cited for the palpably erroneous standard, the court seems to go back and forth between clearly erroneous and palpably erroneous.
It has never been really clear to me. They're both really wrong, right?
I think that's right. They're both really wrong. The court is left with a firm conviction that it's really wrong.
So you agree that as we go through the subsection 7, there's different standards of review. One for contract, one for ship, another one for medical necessity. It's your position. It's not probably running straight through.
That's correct, John. The standard of review varies depending on whether it's a factual or mixed factual and a legal question or a legal question. And the point I would like to make about the Paul's Electrical case is that the Supreme Court there held that the commissioner's interpretation, well, that the agency's interpretation of a statute is only entitled to deference if the statute expressly confers discretion on the agency to interpret that statute. And there is no such discretion conferred on the insurance commissioner in Chapter 432. And in fact, one of the examples.
If you had this specific procedure in Chapter 6, would we have this as an issue? I mean, I understand your argument, you agree with today, the cross-references, incorporation by reference, etc. But if this particular procedure was listed in Chapter 6, this would probably not be an issue.
Your Honor, that's correct. If the commissioner's order concluded, if HMSA had identified in Chapter 6 allogeneic stem cell transplant to treat multiple myeloma, then we would have a specific exclusion. But there are major practical and policy problems with an interpretation that requires that plans list every possible treatment or every possible disease for which treatment would not be excluded. The commissioner actually identified three approaches. One would be that identify every condition for which that treatment is not medically appropriate in Chapter 6. That's unworkable because at this point there is just a handful of conditions for which medical science has concluded allotransplant is medically appropriate. It makes much more sense to list those as exceptions to the exclusion. There are thousands, tens of thousands of conditions for which allotransplant would not be medically appropriate, and if HMSA undertook to list all of them in Chapter 6, the plan would be hundreds of pages long and completely unreadable to the average consumer. So that's a practical. The commissioner also identified as reasons why this was not a specific exclusion because Chapter 6 did not exclude all coverage for multiple myeloma or allotransplant altogether without equivocation. The policy implications of that approach are also, I think, something that we should not be encouraging. Multiple myeloma is a fatal illness. We don't want plans excluding all coverage for multiple myeloma. And allotransplant has been shown to be beneficial in some cases, so we don't want plans excluding all coverage for allotransplant. But if faced with the option of listing tens of thousands of conditions in Chapter 6 for which it would not be appropriate or excluding it altogether, one can see where the temptation could be to exclude it altogether. And I don't think that that's what we want to encourage. being able to specifically exclude coverage for a condition is important. And in this way, as a general rule, this is excluded, except in these specific situations, is important to plans and to members. The commission found that this language would communicate to a member the extent of their coverage, and that, of course, is the ultimate purpose of the plan document, so that the member knows what's covered and what isn't. And for the insurance, the insurer, the health plan, it's important to have confirmed in the document what the health plan is going to be required to cover and what it isn't, because that's how you price coverage. It's not unlike any contract where the party from whom performance is owed needs to know what they're going to have to do. In a situation, in this case is a very good example, where the plan thought they had specifically excluded coverage for multiple myeloma, if the language, and the commissioner found that that was clear, if the language of the statute, the specifically excluded language, is used to override the clear language of the contract, which was consistent with the member's expectations. I mean, this is not a situation where the reasonable expectations of the insured would have been for coverage. The commissioner found that.
So if we can move briefly to this, we've gone halfway through your time already, on whether or not, assuming we go beyond issue number one, whether or not the HMSA acted reasonably.
Thank you. Who filed the appeal for that the administrator? Is it Mr. Adams or was it Dr. Stein?
Dr. Stein appealed the decision internally, and I believe Mr. Adams actually filed the appeal with the insurance commissioner, but as I stand here today, I'm not.
I was a little bit struck by the fact that the notice of medical denial that went to Mr. Adams did not cover the based on the fact that this allied treatment was a clinical or investigative treatment, and that's another system exclusion under Chapter 6. Whereas the letter that went to Dr. Stein excluded it on the basis that auto stem cell treatments are excluded. And it seems like the commissioner already started to keep that all focused on the specific exclusion for the auto transplant, and then went into the medical necessity. So it having just totally dropped out of the clinical trials exception.
Your Honor, whether something is in a clinical trial is certainly evidence of whether it's medically necessary if we get to that point. Something is still being evaluated for safety and efficacy, it's not going to meet the standard of known to be effective. The exclusion for investigational, experimental or investigational treatments was something that we argued, and it was something that the commissioner rejected, but it was not an issue that we chose to pursue on appeal. There's a great deal of overlap between the medical necessity analysis and the investigational exclusion. So the arguments that we made with respect to whether it was medically necessary would also support a conclusion, not medically necessary, arguably investigational, but in terms of trying to prioritize the issues that we brought before the court, we already had six, so we didn't pursue the investigational exclusion as well. And you're correct that the initial denial was on the basis of the current state of medical evidence as it existed at that point, indicating to the medical director that it was investigation,
and
not known to improve health outcomes.
And the medical journal articles that demonstrate that it's no longer investigational.
It's a wonderful segue into the active reasonable category. The New England Journal of Medicine study was published 3 weeks after HMSA made its decision, and it did arguably change the standard of care for the patient population in that study. For the treatment study, which was a tandem auto followed by auto, which is what Mr. Adams had in 2006, versus auto followed by allo, which is not what Dr. Stein is requesting at this point, but the New England Journal of Medicine study became the centerpiece of the commissioner's decision and frankly, of Mr. Adams' argument. Which was inappropriate because it was not information that HMSA could possibly have taken into consideration in making its decision. And
the same time, we're talking about patients' bill of rights, right? This whole scheme. And the real question, you know, to me, and I don't know if it's adequately addressed in the statute, is whether or not there was coverage, you know, assuming we get the issue of whether or not patients have reasonably as to medical necessity. And there was a request, supposedly, to reconsider at the hearing based on an article that was given the day before. What happens when, in this case, HMSA didn't have it, and so didn't act unreasonably, but information comes to HMSA and this panel after the denial, which would demonstrate there should have been a different result if this, in fact, were the case? What's the procedure? What happens? How do you deal with it?
The insurance commissioner only has jurisdiction over final internal determinations made after a member exhausts the plan's complaints and appeals process, and that did not happen with respect to any request for reconsideration on the record. So, allowing me to use hindsight for a moment as to how it could have been done in order to actually comply with the statute so that the commissioner could have had jurisdiction. When that study was published on March 15th, instead of sitting on it, giving it to HMSA on March 22nd, the day before the hearing, Mr. Adams could have made a new request to HMSA based on the New England Journal of Medicine study, requested an expedited review, which must be made within 72 hours, and if HMSA did not agree to provide coverage based on the New England Journal of Medicine study initially, Mr. Adams could have requested an expedited appeal, which would have been in another 72 hours. HMSA would have had to act on his appeal, and if HMSA upheld its denial, then Mr. Adams could have been back in the insurance division with a decision that had exhausted the complaints and appeals procedure with a final internal determination in less than a week.
And that's the only procedure available to deal with a situation like this.
That's the only procedure contemplated under Chapter 432.
And there's no rules. I haven't seen anything cited in the rules of the contract.
There have been no rules issued.
You know, under Chapter 1, says that the determinations and interpretations and decisions are subject to due medical review and review. So does that mean that we're doing anything that is not considered by HMSA?
The de novo review language replaced language that said HMSA had reserved discretion to interpret its plan language. And so the de novo review is to eliminate this discretion to interpret the plan language. The commissioner can take a look at HMSA's plan language and does not have to necessarily afford it the deference in that way. However, the statute imposes an active reasonably standard, and what the commissioner and the circuit court did was read that standard out of the statute, which is very deliberately placed there by the legislature over a couple of years. We cited the legislative history in the appendix to our reply. They imposed a de novo review out of expediency, and it's completely contrary to the language of the statute. They being the commissioner who argued to the circuit court that the acted reasonably standard didn't mean acted reasonably, but rather allowed for a de novo review by considering information that did not exist and was not available to HMSA, the court treated it as if the standard of review under 432E-6 was de novo, when in fact it was acted reasonably.
But I think, don't we need to separate the acting reasonably for bad faith analysis as opposed to just the commissioner's determination of whether this was covered or not?
Certainly, reasonableness is very important to whether a plan committed bad faith, and the commissioner's conclusion of law number 5 that HMSA committed bad faith is unsupported either legally or factually. So yes, that standard applies there. But we also have an external review statute which constrains the commissioner's jurisdiction to reviewing final internal determinations to determine whether the plan acted reasonably. And as we're all aware, agency jurisdiction is strictly constrained by statute. And that's what the legislature gave the commissioner after a couple rounds of revision, is you get to look at the final internal determination, which was made at a specific point in time, and you get to determine whether they acted reasonably. And here, by considering evidence and information that the plan procedure for that and whether...
The procedure was contrary to that they needed to follow the original.
That's correct, John. I've exhausted my time unless the panel has additional questions.
Rafael Del Castillo, and I'm here on behalf of the estate of Randy Adams, Brooklyn's 27th Street. I did not bring this back to multiple my home. I'll address the two questions that Mr. Brooklyn raised, was specifically excluded. And in thinking about this, and I would like to, I know the court is interested in talking about the palpably erroneous standard of review. If I may, I'd like to defer to Mr. Weber on that. That is, Commissioners, one of the commissioners from the points, of course, and I don't want to tread on his territory. In attempting to put this in context for the court and even for myself, thinking about oral argument today, I thought about what if HMSA had asked me to advise it concerning the plan language that we are confronted with here today. And I noted that on page 3 and page 45, there's language that's inconsistent with the statute, and I certainly would have pointed out to HMSA that the language was inconsistent with the medical necessity statute, because it says to receive benefits, the care you receive must be a covered treatment, service, or supply. And then it refers the reader to chapter 4, the description of benefits for the listing of covered treatments, services, and supplies. Page 45 says, even if a service or supply is not specifically listed as an exclusion, it will not be covered unless it's described in Chapter 4. And that language is inconsistent with the medical necessity statute, which very simply, and across the plan language, of course, is that it's covered if it's medically necessary and it's not specifically excluded. We also have in the language of the statute, this is a covered category, but I don't think that's an issue in this case because, as Ms. Brookins explained, multiple myeloma certainly was a covered disease, and bone marrow or stem cell transplants certainly were covered procedures.
What does covered category
of
service mean?
I'm a little trouble here, I'm sorry.
What does covered category of service mean?
That language is not necessarily described any place else, and I believe that one of the reasons the statute provides for a panel to hear these cases, which has some expertise, a plan administrator, a physician, as well as a hearing officer, is in part because of these terms specifically excluded in covered category, and does provide for the panel to make determinations about the plan language based upon the terms of the medical necessity statute and requirements. The a covered category, as we understand it, and we believe as it's been applied, is, for example, surgery is a category of health intervention.
It's a service, right? It's not the disease. It's the kind of services. So bone marrow transplants are a category of service.
Definitely. There's nothing that I know of that excludes diseases as covered categories or not covered categories. In other words, if the plan was, and I think the commissioner's position in the case was, if the plan said multiple myeloma was not covered, then, for example, it might not be covered. And to offer an example that might be consistent with that, been a lot of controversy about obesity in terms of gastric bypass procedures. And numerous plans exclude gastric bypass procedures for obesity. It's generally considered to be a disease, and yet obesity is not a disease that's treated by plans. And so it's a gray area, I think, for us to necessarily consider that diseases can fall into categories, but certainly in the usage, they are, from time to time, turned up as categories. And we've actually had a case concerning obesity and gastric bypass that went up on appeal to the First Circuit Court. I've answered that question, Your Honor, I'd like to move on to the point that I was making in terms of categories of the plain language.
Can I ask you to respond to essentially HMSA's counsel question and answer with me in terms of the way she read this plan? She took us all through it, going through six and back to four. I'm looking at chapter four. I see, there's multiple myeloma under one type of bone marrow transplant and not another. And six is incorporated by reference. And she, at least to me, gave a very credible explanation, even though this is not specifically listed in part six. There's no other way to read this. And for one procedure is covered and one procedure is excluded by it not being there.
Which goes exactly to my point. The point is not whether it is listed as a covered service. And what I would advise patients say is, we list all the covered services we want, but the statute says that it's medically necessary, it's covered unless you specifically exclude it. So if you don't want to cover allogeneic bone marrow transplants for multiple myeloma, you better say so.
Well, she essentially says they said so, but not specifically listing that along with other items in six. With your position, unless it's in part six, you go to medical necessity.
Would it be my position?
Would it be unless specific procedures in part six, it's not excluded? Would that be your position?
It's covered. If it's not listed, if it's not specifically excluded according to the statute, it's covered because
I'm saying in part six, what if it's specifically excluded by reading part four and six together?
The way in which part four and part six are being read together in this case, Your Honor, is contrary to the requirements of the statute. The reason I say that is because the statute's quite plain. It says it has to be specifically excluded. The statute does not provide you room to include as specifically excluded something that is not listed as covered.
And what's the purpose of the statute? Put the consumer on notice of what's covered and what's excluded?
Absolutely not.
Well, that's not the purpose of the service.
The purpose of the statute is to put plans on notice as to how they must structure their plan if they wish to exclude specific procedures.
And why would they do that? Is put somebody else on notice, or just the legislature just had to think about that particular form?
Well,
what's the purpose?
The preamble to this act, 1998, says that the purpose of the act was to interdict the abuses in managed care. It doesn't refer to consumers or consumers reading or consumer position and so forth. And then like that, it's a consumer protection statute. Governs planning. And it governs the circumstances and specifically describes the circumstances in which plans can deny benefit. That's what the medical necessity statute has been used for.
Well, the external review panel specifically found that LO treatments were not a covered benefit. So
is
it not covered to me? I'm having trouble with that logic.
It's definitely troubling, and that's why after much thought, came up with my example about how, as a lawyer, I would advise agency, because it is a troubling notion. Here the commissioner is saying it's clearly not a covered benefit. The statute says if it's medically necessary, it is covered, unless you specifically exclude it. And the reason for that, in part, beyond the bounds of making insurance contracts clear and understandable and not unfair to consumers, the reason for that, too, is also the dynamic and changing this landscape of medical care in the first place.
But isn't that a reason to, HMSA says it's just not earthly possible for all these possible solutions to be listed. We have an unworkable contract, an understandable contract, so it doesn't make sense.
Well, It's a seductive argument, Your Honor, but it's not what the statute says, and it's not what the statute requires, and it isn't, in fact, consonant with reality, because specific things that you would exclude, for example, allogeneic and bone marrow transplants for, can be enumerated in a 75-page document, or addenda to the documents, or change in the documents. One of the problems with this case is the fact that and that gets to my second point. If HMSA had showed me the list of diseases, I would have said, you understand that you can't exclude things by listing coverage. You have to exclude things by excluding them. So your list of diseases is fine, but it doesn't mean that something left off of the list is not, that is excluded. It simply means that you have a list that is covered. But as far as the medical necessity statute is concerned, if it meets all the requirements, it's going to be covered. It's not going to be excluded. Unless you say, we don't want to cover allogeneic transplants for multiple myeloma. And I would tell them also that if you're going to exclude that in your list, you better make sure that the diseases that you've got in your list are not diseases that nobody would ever describe or prescribe a bone marrow transplant for, because that's irrational. And it suggests that it's ambiguous, it could be illusory, even unfair, because it makes the plan benefits look more expansive and like a better value than they in fact are. That's exactly what the insurance commissioner was worried about in this case. There was, in fact, two diseases on this list that nobody would ever prescribe a transplant for. The list is illusory, and it's not reliable. It doesn't change. It doesn't add new diseases, and it doesn't deal with the circumstance that we have here, where we, I can only say this very quickly because of my time, but at the hearing, we made application for HMSA to reconsider, and they finally, at the hearing, did not.
Where's the application for reconsideration? Your request for reconsideration is based on what statute or rule?
It was based simply on the fact that we have a right to ask HMSA to cover a benefit over again if they deny it on a basis that's no longer valid.
And that right comes from where?
I'm not citing to a statute. I'm citing to the fact that the patient is covered by the plan. And he's still entitled to a covered benefit just because we're hearing a case based on a decision that's too
result in court. If you move for reconsideration, you have to cite a rule. In that procedure, you don't. You just, because it's the right thing to do.
No, Your Honor, because it's an administrative hearing, number one, it's not a court. Number two, it elevates form over substance. And number three, I've got a man sitting next to me who is going to die. And making him go back through a procedure that's unnecessary when the representative for the plan and the attorneys for the plan are sitting there and they make a decision and they're familiar with the clinical study that we're referring to, and they deny it anyway. To me, that's a final denial. And it was confirmed to be a final denial, so let's... As far as
so we were concerned, bad faith to not reconsider based on a request that's not based on any statute.
I don't believe that the statute specifies that you cannot make applications to the plan, for example, in the middle of the external review hearing, to reconsider. I don't find anything in the statute or the plan. The plan says you've got to make applications. Certain procedures, but I don't find anything in the statute that says that you cannot deviate from that rule if the circumstances warrant. And to do so would be to elevate a form over substance.
Well, isn't that what you're doing with the plan, elevating a form over substance? Could terms only be written one particular way?
I'm not suggesting it can only be written one particular
way. Your way, because you would advise HMSA. That's pretty much what you're putting forth. If you were the lawyer, you would advise him to write it this way, and that's the only way the statute allows. It's in that form of the substance.
I would have to disagree with that, Your Honor, because the statute itself is focused upon substance of coverage. And we, at some point, have to be governed by the coverage that's approved in the plan. A difficult question to answer in a short period of time. if you'll forgive me, if I need to go address it very briefly, the statute.
I think it's okay. I don't think that's good.
was, for convenience perhaps, the commissioner's decision, the commissioner this and that. The decider here at the administrative level, if you will, is a panel of three statutorily composed of the commissioner or his designee, a practitioner, a medical practitioner not involved, of course, in the case, and a managed care plan representative also. So the statutory scheme that the legislature has established, we contend, and this is where we get to the argument concerning the palpably erroneous standard, or at least deference to the panel's decision, it is clearly established as a panel of experts, if you will, with a background in medicine, family care, and regulatory.
How about contract law? Experts in contract law?
There are no specifications for a contract lawyer, if you will, Your Honor. Perhaps that would be most embodied by the presence of the commissioner.
Should we give them any deference in terms of construing the contract?
I believe, yes, Your Honor, because of the way the statute establishes, or the way it sets up what they are considered, first of all, it says who they are, and they are picked clearly out of categories with particular backgrounds. They are to decide certain things, looking at them among the things of contract. And because the decision that the panel makes has been written up and signed by the commissioner, the decision necessarily applies the facts of whatever kind of case or disease or condition it may be that's under consideration in light of the insurance contract and applicable law. And as a result, of course, it results in a decision that is a mixed question of fact or law.
But if you take counsel for Mr. Adams, basically it's a matter of statutory construction and whether the contract or the parts 4 and 6 comply with the statute. That's certainly not within the expertise of these panelists, is it? Why should we give them deference? In fact, couldn't the statute be construed and the contract be construed differently from one panel to another? I mean, that's a little bit different than medical necessity when you're dealing with a particular treatment and a particular patient. And counsel for HMSA concedes some deference, at least in that area, it's merited. But how can we have the statute and the contract construed differently from one panel to another?
I think, Your Honor, that again, it gets back to an application of the language of the contract and the facts under consideration. If it's simply a question of interpreting the language of the contract, just to read chapters 4 and 6 or whatever sections of the plan may be for the purely abstract issue of does this exclude or cover a particular condition, perhaps again in the abstract, that's purely a question of contract law or statutory interpretation. But I would emphasize.
Well, in your answering brief, you do say that a proposed service is if it's a proposed service is specifically excluded in the plan, you don't need it to the medical necessity determination.
That's correct, and here we maintain that there is no specific excluded in the plan, and that the.
Who makes that determination? Because if you look at the statutory scheme, it looks like the medical director for a managed care plan makes decisions based on medical necessity or other standards. And then when you look at the medical necessity statute, you know, when there's a disagreement between the healthcare provider and the health plan's medical then you send it to an external body for determination of medical necessity. So it doesn't look like that external review process contemplates a decision on whether it's covered. That's a question of law.
I think it necessarily does require that determination, Your Honor, simply because the panel needs to, in light of the contract language and the procedure, particularly requested in this case, so they have to both read the policy or the plan for whether they, in their view, again, as with the background both in certain regulatory, medical, and managed care plan experience, they are expected to read this to apply the language of the plan and the details of the proposed treatment.
And we need to give preference to the town's determination that something is covered or not covered. I could see giving preference to them on the medical necessity because they are sort of experts in the field. Right. In terms of coverage, is that, do you know what we
I believe, again, I believe it is at the very least a mixed question of law and fact. And here it's quite clear that the plan, as we described it, I mean, we can almost pick the language out of the plan, and we, in effect, the bone marrow transplants under consideration here are covered, but, you know, I mean, they clearly are not excluded, but they are also, you might say, conditionally covered. Covered, but only with pre-approval. Covered, but not if it's experimental or something to that effect. And so determination of what covered, and I think that's why, that's the distinction perhaps between the seeming contradiction between if it's covered, of course it's covered. If it's not covered, but not specifically excluded, And that's the point. It is not covered in all situations and all conditions. No question about that. There are conditions, and then because there is no specific exclusion of coverage or coverage for the particular condition situation here, then you get into the medical necessity interpretation and apply that to the situation and the panel included that.
So the insurance commissioner, on whether or not procedure is specifically excluded, is going to turn to an ad hoc panel and not your office for advice, and even though the ad hoc panels may change from time to time.
In this context, that's correct. The panel makes its own decision.
The panel looks at the statute, not your office. And they read the statute, and they read the plan. And then make the determination. Your office is pretty much trumped.
I don't have any, I can't speak quite frankly around the question of if a panel asked for an interpretation or an opinion on some point. I don't know if that's ever come up. I don't know why it couldn't, I'm not aware that they ever have.
Generally, administrative agencies don't interpret. That's always to know. I mean, application of law and how, you know, you give deference to the agency, but not the interpretation. But that's always subject to development of the courts. Otherwise,
I believe that's usually correct, Your Honor. There are some exceptions, of course, but in this instance, the point is not that the legislature has expressly conferred some interpretive power on these boards, but that the board is composed as an expert panel in this particular area, and again, with as counsel from Mr. Adams pointed out, this is typically a rather, well, maybe, and it was certainly here, a fluid situation. Medical technology and science was actually literally advancing as the case went forward. And which, in part, is shown by the fact that this New England Journal article came out following the determination by HMSA before the hearing. And, of course, HMSA was asked, and their representative at the hearing, was asked, did they intend to stand on their prior determination or reconsider in light of this newly published information, and they stated that they would stand on the prior determination. That also, we believe, is something that the panel is well in its competence and authority.
Where is the
Oh, in terms of a procedural or rule-based, like a Rule 59 reconsideration, I believe there is simply no such thing, Your Honor. I believe it's within the discretion of a panel in this circumstance. They are charged with determining whether or not the provider the plan acted reasonably.
Based on information that didn't have at the time.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I submit that, as Mr. Del Castillo indicated, the purpose of the law to get speedy and hopefully accurate and effective resolution of these things just does not suggest that there should be a paper chase that would say that, okay, once you have the final internal determination of the plan, no other factors can be considered than what they had on their desk at that time. And if something comes up, if there's some new information, some change in the patient's condition, then they've just got to go through the whole process from scratch all over again. And they can't consider that in hopefully and presumably a reasonable and fair way.
Also, I'm sure you've litigated a lot. And if somebody handed you a bunch of discovery the day before trial, and the first day of trial, and you're asked to respond to it, so that you need more time to review it, you'd be held in bad faith. Would that be reasonable? You should have been able to review it, consult with your client, make a determination. Isn't that a bit extreme for bad faith?
I believe you're either referring to the bad faith finding in the order, which I referred to in our brief as perhaps at worst a surplusage. The determination that the panel needed to make, and they did make, was that HMSA did not act reasonably in their ultimate refusal.
How do you act unreasonably by not considering something that was not before you, couldn't have been before you at the time? How's that unreasonable?
I think because, given the fact that the patient's life may be at stake and was here, that not to consider that information, which for every intent and then the testimony of the hearing was very substantial and significant information, not to consider that is unreasonable. And that they could have, they did not. And how
so would with my hypothetical, if you were having a bunch of discovery before trial, unless you pretty much gave your life up and reviewed it, your client gave your life up, reviewed it, and everything else we have would be reviewed, so that next day you could make a good judgment call. That if you didn't do that, that'd be impossible. That'd be bad faith.
The difference would be, Your Honor, that in the court proceeding there are specific rules that govern that, and obviously.
If there's no rules, how can you say someone acted in bad faith if there's no rules?
Well, again, Your Honor, I'm not speaking to the bad faith finding, which I think is unnecessary to this decision and adds nothing good to this. It's basically an inflammatory comment. But the determination of unreasonable, the panel, I think, could have easily been asked or been told, we would like to reconsider this. Can we reconvene in a week, or can we reconsider this and come back? None of that, we don't know how that would have played out, but I submit that this panel, as with most administrative proceedings, would have that flexibility and here and its ability to manage
it. HMSA wasn't offered that option, were they?
They were, in fact.
Would you like more time? Would you like to continue this matter?
Well, it was not specifically stated. What was stated was they were at it, the representative was asked. If it was continuing to stand on its denial despite the subsequent information that has been provided, the HMSA representative confirmed we continue to stand on our denial. That's from the transcript of the proceeding of the panel, page 33. That presented an opportunity how that would have played out had they said we would like to consider this further. We simply don't know. But I have no doubt that it's within the competence of the panel to say, we'll give you that opportunity and take it from there.
Well, I think it was something that we never read about, maybe Adams, Mr. and Mrs. Adams first consulted with Dr. Stein. He discussed the option of our treatment, and he also mentioned that there's risk because it suppresses your immune system, and so you might get sicker. And you're also introducing foreign elements into your body, it's a possible risk. And they said they needed to think about it because the downsides to allo treatment were enormous. They actually case them down. So when HMSA denies, when these studies are being developed and come out, they're just based on 150 or 200 people. They're not necessarily based on the same situation as Mr. Adams, where he's only had two auto treatments. Is it unreasonable to need to study it further or to make them prove their case by submitting another application?
I think there was, substantial testimony at the hearing about the interpretation or application of that, of the article, and the influence it had on someone who we highly regarded practitioners who testified. I really can't speak to it more than that, but it was significant and very new article by all accounts, or they certainly have a further consideration before simply saying, no, we'll stay on the one from the right side.
Very, very broad coverage. So in this case, whether this was a covered category of service, and in most cases dealing with group coverage such as this, that's not going to be an issue because if someone has, say, an individual plan that only provides coverage for inpatient admissions, then of course the first thing that would be looked at is, was this for an outpatient visit? If so, it's not a covered category of service. So that's how those portions of the statute work together. Chapter 432E is the patient's bill of rights and responsibilities. And the legislative history for that statute makes very clear that when it was enacted, the legislature acknowledged that we had not encountered in Hawaii the problems with managed care that had been experienced on the mainland. The legislative history actually confirms that we're not doing this to fix a problem in Hawaii. And there are other references in the legislative history to the statute being amended over time in order to achieve a balance between striking an equitable balance between managed care plans and their patients. So the concepts of contract interpretation and the ability to enforce a contract is just as important in dealing with a contract subject for healthcare services subject to the patient's bill of rights and responsibilities as it would be in any context. Roger asked, if some service is not covered, isn't it excluded? And of course it is. Chapter 6 is entitled Services Not Covered. And everyone agrees that that's the exclusions chapter. So the crux of the issue here is what does it take to be a specific exclusion? In this case, the commissioner found that a reasonable person reading the plan language could readily determine that this was not a covered service. That's sufficient specificity. Any of the options for creating additional specificity as the commissioner has proposed are simply unworkable and impractical. There was a discussion by my opposing counsel. The statute doesn't limit the ability to request reconsideration. But the jurisdiction of the panel is limited by statute to final internal determinations. Even though the statute doesn't say can or you cannot request reconsideration, it does say the only thing you can review is a final internal determination issued at the complaint. complaints and appeals process have been exhausted, and an agency cannot exercise discretion, as Mr. Weber suggests, beyond the jurisdiction it's been afforded by the legislature. The statutes don't invest discretion in the three-member ad hoc panel to interpret the language of Chapter 432E. They simply don't. So under the Pulse Electrical Service case, the interpretation of the commissioner or the commissioner's panel is certainly not entitled to any deference. It should be reviewed de novo by this panel. Your Honors, because this service was specifically excluded, there was sufficient specificity as to what was covered and what was excluded. HMSA was entitled to stand on its contract, and it was not necessary to proceed to the medical necessity analysis that the commissioner embarked upon. But even if one gets to that, it is impossible for a plan to act unreasonably by failing to consider information that did not exist, that was not available to it. It completely reads the active reasonably standard out of the statute. We've identified a number of other issues in our briefing, which we believe merit your attention, but those are the two that are foremost in my mind as I had the opportunity this morning to speak with you. Based on the argument today and the arguments set forth in our brief, we respectfully request that the panel reverse the circuit court's decision with instructions to vacate the commissioner's